Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Lee Adams. We review The Gin Game, Clever Little Lies, Perfect Arrangement, Rothschilds and Sons of the York Theatre Company, and Please Excuse My Dear Aunt Sally. Please stay tuned.
A girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so. But that was once upon a time, very long ago.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, October 18th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Are you guys adjusting to the brisk fall change this morning?
I'm headed out to Paper Mill Playhouse this evening to see the Bandstand. Perhaps.
Oh, yes. So. I've been trying to schedule that, and I couldn't because of prior commitments, but I'm looking forward to hearing what you say about that next week.
Yeah, and maybe I'll see some nice fall foliage, too.
Peter, are you going to get out and see that?
Yes, I am. I'll be there tonight as well.
All right. So I want the listeners, if you have a moment, to jump on over to iTunes and leave us a review, because good reviews help other people find us, and I've been neglecting asking folks to do that at the top of the show, so I just wanted to do my quarterly reminder of that. With us this morning, we have the Tony Award-winning lyricist Lee Adams, who is joining us on a Sunday morning. Lee, thank you for getting up on a Sunday and visiting with us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So next Sunday, October 25th at the National Arts Club, you're going to be honored by the Encompass New Opera Theater. And we just wanted to let our listeners know about that and just add to the long list of honors that has come your way from Bye Bye Birdie and Golden Boy and Applause and so many others. Thank you so much for your contribution to the Broadway community.
Well, thank you.
My question is, Charles Strauss often says, when we went out of town with Bye Bye Birdie, we didn't have any trouble because we didn't know we were supposed to have trouble. I've heard him say that quite often. Yeah, that you were so naive about show business. Any truth to that? I mean, it's a good line.
Well, everybody on Birdie was unknown except Cheetah Rivera. Mm-hmm. She'd been in West Side Story. She wasn't a star yet. Mm-hmm. Dick Van Dyke was completely unknown. The whole cast was unknown. It was Gower Champion's first job as director. Huh. The writers were all completely unknown, and we came to New York from Philadelphia with absolutely no advance sale. We were a complete sleeper. The entire theater community said, a rock musical, what does that mean? I mean, it was just beyond the pale. Nobody could think that these people could do a musical like ours. And so we knew that we had to have good reviews. In those days, in 1960, there were 7 daily papers in New York. Mm. Yeah. Television hadn't really got started yet. And so we had to get reviews. And as always, the New York Times was the most important, because if you don't get the Times, you're dead. That's like a truism of the theater. So we waited for the reviews, and in those days, the reviewers went to the opening night, and they rushed to their typewriters, and they batted out a review, and the reviews started to come in, and someone would come into the cast party with a review in his hand and read it. The first review in was the New York Times. It was Brooks Atkinson, the dean of the reviewers, And Mr. Atkinson gave Bye Bye Birdie 8 short paragraphs, all negative, and the last paragraph, the last line of which I will never forget. Brooks Atkinson said, "It is neither fish nor fowl nor good musical comedy." So we thought we were dead. And the cast party immediately came to a hushed halt. Everybody went home, many of them us thinking we were finished. But then the other reviews began to come in, and they were all good. And we thought maybe we had a chance. And the show built up a little momentum. The word of mouth was good. And we found suddenly we had a hit.
Well, go ahead.
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
That's all. And so after a few months of this, and the show was an established hit, I went to my boss at the magazine where I worked, and I said, "I'm afraid I have to give up my job." He said, "I was waiting for you to come in and tell me that." Finally, I no longer had to be a magazine editor. I could be a lyricist.
Well, for many years, we were all fooled, those of us who had not seen that review, because, of course, the quotation on the original cast album said, "The audience was beside itself with pleasure."
And and the sentence after that was something like, "But I could not agree with them," or something like that.
Very, very clever of your advertising people to pull that.
Oh, sure. Oh, no, that's what they do.
Yeah, so that was really terrific.
I've always had a question, and this is my perfect opportunity, about the lyrics for Put on a Happy Face. The first few lines were rewritten for the film version. And I've always wondered, did you do that because it was felt that maybe the song was a little overfamiliar? Or was there some other reason?
You know, I'm 91 years old. I forget. Mm-hmm. I forget that there was a different version. Give me the lines that were.
Oh, well, in the show, and I believe the song had already become quite a hit. Mm-hmm. Gray skies are going to clear up, put on a happy face, brush off the clouds and cheer up, put on a happy face.
Right.
But the film, it's why look so awfully tragic, put on a happy face, smiling can work like magic, put on a happy face.
I have no recollection of that. I may have written that. I don't know why. You know, when you do a movie, they do a movie. They don't do a stage show.
Right.
And so they do what they pay all this money, and they do whatever they want to do.
Well, I always thought I was going to get the answer, and
not much of an answer.
That's fine.
I'd completely forgotten that.
I understand it, though, for the movie Bye Bye Birdie, you guys were a little reluctant to write a titled song. Do you remember anything about that?
Well, I do. We didn't think the Broadway show needed a title song, but the movies in those days, they required a title song. And so we sat down and wrote Bye Bye Birdie, that song.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for it was that George Sidney, the director, had the hots for Anne Margaret wanted her to start the movie with a song.
Mm-hmm.
And we never, I never really liked that song very much. It's a sort of cliche, but what the heck? You do what you do. And so that's the way it was.
I should mention I'm distantly related to one of the producers, I guess the lead producer of Bye Bye Birdie, Edward Padula.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah.
It's
not somebody not someone I ever met, so that's how distant it is.
Uh-huh.
Ed Padula, we called him.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Maybe that's this.
Or as John Raitt used to call him, Crazy Ed Padula. But there you were. And I remember hearing from Charles Strauss that L. Slade Brown was very important in getting Bye Bye Birdie on.
Oh, he was. He was an interesting fellow. Had a banker from Texas, I believe, and he was hooked on the show. Another reason the show got on the stage at all was Goddard Lieberson at Columbia Records, who liked the show a lot, and put money into it. And so, Birdie came in for $300,000, Today, that wouldn't even buy the costumes. It was a low-budget thing, and what? Who knows?
Now, Charles Strauss is very famous for recycling songs, and I've always felt bad for you and the other lyricists he's worked with, because, of course, there are times when he sits back, gives you a song, and says, do a new lyric for it. For the most hilarious one, of course, is His Royal Highness from I and Albert, which became You Can Never Go Back and Bring Back Birdie. Did you ever resent the fact that there he was by the pool sunning himself while you were in the hotel room writing a lyric?
No, that's the way it works. Sometimes, usually when Charles and I work together, people ask what comes first, the music or the lyrics. With us, it was the idea. Because when you write for the theater, you're not just writing songs. You're writing for a character in a scene, in a plot. And it's a different craft than just writing songs. Often we would get an idea for a song together in a room. Does this scene need a song? If so, what should it be? Perhaps we get a title. Then I'd go off and write a lyric, come back to Charles. He'd criticize it. We work it over, back and forth like that, and finally we'd get a song. So it's not unusual for the lyricist to go off and write several lyrics, at least in my judgment, it's not unusual.
Since the since Peter brought it up, another thing I've always wondered about, and maybe you can tell me, is that really one of the most, I think, beautiful, gorgeous songs ever written in musical theater history is Once Upon a Time from All American. Do you know, recall if that was partly a trunk song or completely a trunk song?
That was a trunk song because, as I remember, we wrote that song for a review at Green Mansions in the Adirondacks.
Ah.
And we were looking for a song for All American, and this seemed to fit the bill.
Well, thank you for telling me that. That song is so gorgeous.
Well, thank you so much.
Really?
Yeah, everybody loves that one, including Tony Bennett, of course, who was an important building block in its success. Were you intimidated when the idea of All About Eve came up, the idea of a musical of All About Eve, as Betty Comden and Adolph Green have often written? So many people know this movie by heart, and they care about it like a mother hen. Those are actually Cobden and Green's words. Was it intimidating to go to bat for that show? And,
not at all. It wasn't intimidating because Betty and Adolph were so wonderful to work with. It was the only show, I believe, for which they wrote the book but not the lyrics.
Yeah.
And we had such respect for each other. It was just a joyful experience. That was not intimidating at all. Bacall was wonderful in that show, and she was a great trooper, and it worked. The show worked.
One of your greatest lyrics, of course, had to be cut from that show. I saw it in Baltimore, by the way, so I heard the song Be Done, and that's Smashing New York Times, where you talk about the fact that we base our lives on the reviews we get.
Yeah.
That we're more concerned with what critics say than what our loved ones say to us. And what a great idea. And I thought the song worked perfectly well. Was it hard to let that one go?
Yes. Yeah, it was hard, but it seemed to hold up the flow of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's what happens when you write the kind of musical theater we wrote. You don't just drop the songs in. You have to. There has to be linked to the story and the characters. I found one of the most challenging things I had to do as a lyricist was get the right vocabulary for the characters.
Mm.
So many writers don't mm-hmm. know how to do that very well.
Right, right.
And it's very challenging. I go back to Guys and Dolls. Frank Lesser knew the exact vocabulary of those mm-hmm. characters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's why the show works so well.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that he knew how they would talk.
Yes.
And so you have to find the right vocabulary, and you have to get inside that character's head and know how that character would do this moment in song.
Your fellow honoree at the upcoming Encompass New Opera Gala is Barbara Cook, who never starred in a Strauss Adams show that I know of, but I'm wondering about your association with her over the years. I'm sure she's sung many of your guys' songs, et cetera.
Well, I don't know her very well. We've met. She's everybody's favorite singer. She's mm-hmm. absolutely brilliant, mm-hmm. and everyone in the musical theater knows that. But it's a great honor to be honored along with her, I'll tell you mm-hmm. that.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about your history. Bye Bye Birdie is a musical that defines a period of time in the American history that a lot of people go back to and look to with much happiness. And another project that you worked on was All in the Family, and the opening theme song, Those Were the Days,
yeah.
quite possibly could be your most played song ever. It could be.
Well, yeah, it was a lot of people have heard that song. It was a strange thing. We'd written a movie with Norman Lear, The Night They Raided Minsky's,
mm-hmm.
and when Norman got the rights to this English comedy, it was called, I forget what it was called in England, but he wanted to call it Those Were the Days. And so he said, would Charles and I write a title song? And he said, I can't pay you much money for it because I haven't sold this series yet, but I'll give you a piece of the publishing.
Oh, there you go.
And so, yeah, we wrote it. and then we sort of forgot about it because it took Norman 3 years to get it on television. Finally, we read in the paper that this show called
All in the Family.
Yeah, All in the Family.
Yeah,
was going on CBS, and we figured our title song was not in.
Yeah, yeah.
So we called Norman. He said, "Yeah, watch the show anyway." We watched the show, and there was our song. Why he used that as a title song, I don't know. He said he liked it, and so it was an interesting thing.
All right, now there's a 45 of it where there are more lyrics. Everybody seemed content. $50 paid the rent. Freaks was in a circus tent. Those were the days.
Yeah.
I remember that vividly. Was that something that you wrote for the pilot, or was it something that came later?
We wrote a traditional four stanza song.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And for the television show, they cut out one stanza.
I see.
To make it shorter.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened.
Uh huh.
Those are my lyrics.
How many people came up to you and said, "What is that thing she's saying about Sal Red?" the LaSalle lyric was
we
one.
We are
that,
old LaSalle Ren great.
Right, and was one that she didn't sing very clearly.
I had phone calls when that show was hot on television. I had phone calls all the time. What is that damn line?
Yeah,
because it looks good on paper, but apparently it when you sing it, it doesn't resonate. And so I once said to Norman Lear about the second or third year of the show, put a crawl under that, for God's sake, so people will stop calling me.
Well, they didn't do that, but they did. I distinctly remember when they re-recorded it. And it was really,
yes, right.
It was
That's
really
right.
funny because, you know, at first it was G.R. Old LaSalle ran great, but then the second time was G.R. Old LaSalle ran.
Right, they enunciated it better. And, you know, my father had a LaSalle, a funny old.
Oh, guy. Really?
So how did a boy from Mansfield, Ohio, make his way from the Ohio State University, the great Ohio State University? To New York?
Well, like many people in the Midwest, I gravitated to New York. I wrote a college show at Ohio State, wrote six songs for this terrible college show called Howdy Stranger.
Uh-huh.
I came to New York, to get my master's in journalism. I was a journalist.
Oh, the J School, yeah.
And I met Charles Strauss through a friend, and I took six songs of my score for this so-called show, and he sight-read it, which was pretty impressive to me. Mm-hmm. And I was very proud of these six songs, and I said to Charles, "Well, what do you think?" "Well," he said, "the prosody in this song is not right, and the rhyme scheme here is just terrible." Mm-hmm. And he decimated my songs, and I was very hurt. I left. I went back to my basement room near Columbia University. In the middle of the night, I got up, and I looked at those songs, and he was right. I thought, boy, there's an honest guy, a smart guy, a guy who knows how to write songs. Maybe I should see him again. And that was 65 years ago.
Wow. I saw Golden Boy Out of Town in Boston when Gimme Some opened the show. I understand that the character in a Broadway musical really was based on Sammy Davis because he gave you a bit of trouble as time went on. True, false?
I don't remember any trouble with Sammy Davis.
Okay.
He was exacting. He was fun to work with. But he was a brilliant, brilliant talent. He was at the top of his game. A wonderful ear for music. You know, often in a musical, if a song comes out of dialogue in a certain way, in the orchestra they will put an oboe note or something to cue him as to what his first note is. And when Sammy heard that in an orchestra run-through, he stopped the thing. He said, wait, I don't need that note. I know where that note is. And he did. He was brilliant.
Good. That's nice to hear. I want to tell you that one of my readers said he misunderstood one of your lyrics, and I think this will amuse you. In Welcome to the Theater, there's a lyric, "Welcome to the Philadelphia Critics. Welcome, Librium and Nebutol."
Yeah.
And he said to me, I was so young when I heard that lyric, I thought those were the names of the Philadelphia critics, Librium and Nebutol.
That is very funny. I guess those drugs are out of fashion now.
Well, it's interesting in the song, Who's That Girl? Yeah. I mean, Applause opened in 1970, correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there were all those references that I'm sure at that point, probably everyone in the audience still got them. But now I'm sure that there must be some people who don't know what Mella Rooney is. And
right. Of course. And you know, in Birdie, Ed Sullivan hymn.
Mm-hmm.
Many people today never heard of Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
And so. I don't know how they keep doing it when the show is done.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, our little show Birdie is going to play all next summer at Goodspeed in Connecticut.
Oh, that's right.
Oh.
And then it's going on a national tour, I'm told.
Mm-hmm.
So it still pays the rent.
Did you ever meet Ed Sullivan? Did you ever talk about that song with him?
No, never met. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Let me go back to your meeting with Mr. Strauss back in the Columbia days. How old were you at the time?
Oh, well, I don't know. I was in the Army for 3 years, interrupting my college. I was in my 30s somewhere. I don't know.
So the
late 20s.
So if the internet is correct, and it's not always correct, it says here that Strauss is 4 years younger than you.
That's correct.
So
he's a youngster.
He's just a mere 87, you know. You know, was there any feeling that, you know, I'm 4 years older than you and a lot more experienced, and, you know, am I going to take this advice from this kid from the Eastman School of Music?
No, not at all. Charles knew so much about music and about songs. I learned so much from him. I never tried to pull rank, believe me.
Well, one of my favorite lyrics of all time comes from a show that only lasted one night, and that's a Broadway musical. The title song, which is so wonderful, a real tribute to a Broadway musical, even though it contains the lyric, it doesn't have one redeeming feature, a Broadway musical.
Yeah.
But at the end...
I like that song, too.
But when it works...
I've wiped out a lot of memories of that show because it really bombed.
Yeah, but the lyric at the end, but when it works, forget the jerks who told you it wouldn't go, because there's nothing like a Broadway show.
Yeah. Well, I like to hear that.
That's the lyric, and I think there's a lot of truth in it. And I do say that people who have reviews in their hometowns should look up that song. It's a great way to open a show or close a show about Broadway music. Terrific song.
Well, I hope people do that and the song becomes a huge hit.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So looking back at shows like It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, which had an Encores production a couple of years back, did you... feel the need to go back and tinker with anything, or is there...
Absolutely not. No, I love that show. And so did Hal Prince. No one ever really figured out why it didn't work longer than it did. The Encore did a great job of it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good satire, and that's what we intended to do. But for some reason, people didn't come and see it. Hal always said it may be because at that time there was twice a week on television a Superman show.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
If that's true, I don't remember. But that could be the reason. But that always puzzled me because every time I look at that score, I think it's very good.
Well, especially the lyric in Lois Lane's song, where she talks about wanting a man with both feet on the ground. That's terrific.
Yeah. I'm proud of that.
You should be.
We've talked about that before. That's one of our favorite lyrics.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning, and for you not getting up early, because we mentioned before that you get up much, much earlier than we've talked here. But I want to remind our listeners that the tribute is coming up next week, and we'll have links in our show notes if you'd like to see if you can attend that tribute. And Mr. Adams, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you, guys.
All right.
Absolutely.
Once upon a time, very long ago, once upon a time, we sat beneath a willow tree.
All right, in our review section, the three of us got a chance to see The Gin Game, which opened up at the Golden Theater earlier this week. So, Peter, why don't you get us started on that?
I liked it quite a bit, and of all the productions I've seen, that includes the original with Hume Cronin and Jessica Tandy and that revival that we had with Julie Harris and Charles Durning, I think this is easily one of the best of the three. Mm. In fact, it's the best of the seven productions I've seen of this play, and I think some of it has to do with the fact that you really believe these people are old. Cronin was only 66, and Tandy was 68 when they did it, and while we were all, 37 years younger than... The fact remains that even though they seemed old to us then, these people do seem older because they genuinely are. Jones is 84 and Tyson is anywhere from 82 to 91, depending on who you believe, so who knows. But anyway, but there's plenty of life in these people, and that's what's really great, And, I do have a question about the play, though. As much as I like both James Earl Jones and Cicely Tyson in it, I've always wondered when I see this play, given the fact that he is always losing, why does he always deal the cards? Why doesn't he at some point say, "You deal this time"? I mean, that makes no sense to me.
Knowing the play that well, I only saw it once. I only saw that revival you mentioned. I kept expecting him to do exactly that.
Yeah, I think that's a very strange thing, you know. So, yeah, and what I loved, the audience that I was really with this play. I mean, they laughed heartily more than any production I've seen. And they got very sentimental when Jones and Tyson started to dance. There's a scene where they dance and the sentimental delight, you know, was really quite nice. And suddenly Tyson seemed very, very young when she was dancing. She suddenly looked like a little girl going to her first dance. So I think this is a very good production. But what I really liked was the set by Ricardo Hernandez, because usually the porch on which they're playing is very neat and orderly. And since there's so much in the play about what a dump this place is and how you get treated badly and all this kind of stuff, it makes perfect sense to have a set with his junk on the back porch for most of it, a refrigerator that obviously doesn't work, a wheelchair behind them to remind us that this is a place where a lot of people need such things. And the chairs they're sitting in are mismatched and don't look terribly comfortable. You know? So I thought that was a very smart set. And as much as I admired James Earl Jones and Cicely Tyson, I admired Ricardo Hernandez just as much for saying, wait a minute, it says in the script that this is not a nice place. Let's make it not a nice porch. So I liked it quite a bit. So under those circumstances, I think this is a terrific production, and I do think it's definitely worth seeing, not just because of the fact we may not see these two people anymore, but the fact that they and we may very well may, because after all, it's a two character play. They have a lot of lines to learn, a lot of things to deal with. And nobody flubbed a line when I was there, I'll tell you. And so we may see these people again. But just in case, you know, don't miss this one. This one's really, really funny and really, really nice.
Michael, what did you think?
I completely agree. But that is so interesting about the set, Peter, because my initial reaction was the opposite. I was like, really? What, you know, even a fourth-rate old age home, would it be that run down? Would the paint be that chipped? And
yes.
would there be that many things on the porch? I think maybe better to go in that direction than the opposite, but I was a little taken aback by it. You don't obviously don't think it was too much in that.
Well, also, I do think that the back porch is a place where they throw things, you know, because in case, you know, visitors come, they probably won't go out to the back porch, you know, so let's get everything out there. So I mean, it made sense to me. Again, okay. I don't insist it makes sense to you, but it did to me.
Well, it's just interesting that, because I'm glad you said it, because you're making me look at it in a different way. I thought it was a lovely production. They're both so extraordinary, both of them. But James Earl Jones, I think, what is it they say? He's done 10 plays in the past 6 years, or six plays in the past 10 years, something like that. He works constantly on stage. He even did one thing we didn't see because it was in Australia. He did
Drive Miss Daisy, right,
with Angela Lansbury. Right. So yeah, they're just like treasures. And she, that little girl quality you mentioned, I think she has that anyway. And I thought that really brought a lot to the play. The two characters are, their backstories are very interesting, and I think that that both of these actors, of course, they're great actors, and they. I think they really played the backstory. I think that there were things they were doing that you could see where these people had come from as you learn more about them, and you say, oh yes, oh I get that. Yes, I thought it was beautiful. I think it was a privilege to see them on stage. I thought it was very well directed by Leonard Folia. I did think the very ending was a little abrupt. The script says something about how when that final defeat in the gin game that James Earl Jones, that Weller Martin has, that something happens to him. It says in the script that it's he lets out some sort of a cry, and it makes the point that you're not supposed to think it's a stroke or anything like that, but I guess it's just him kind of giving up and then retreating into the house while she's calling after him. I thought that seemed a little abrupt. I thought the audience didn't necessarily react in the way that the playwright intended. It seems to me there was a lot of laughter at the end, and then a little confusion as to what the what we were supposed to be thinking was happening. But until then, I really thought it was extraordinary. They were, both of them were so focused. There was so much chemistry, and I'm just very, very glad I got to see it.
I have to put the third mark of approval on this, because we really had a great time. I was just exactly what Peter had said. I was like, I'm so glad I am here to see these two who we could quite possibly never get to see again. And I was thinking back about how much work it is for the two of them to put up this show. I mean, both of them are, the show is 2 hours with a 15-minute intermission, and they're basically on stage for the entire time. This is a lot of work. So I was thinking about You Can't Take It With You, and during that, during our review of that last season, we kind of said, well, what was going on with him early in the run?
Because yes, that's fair.
It was, and I'm thinking, after seeing this the other night, I'm thinking, well, that must have been an acting choice, because he was rock solid.
Yep.
Well, I do think, I do think he still does that thing where he is kind of looking down a little bit, and you can kind of see him focusing on what he's going to say next, and which is only natural, but I think he makes it so organic, and of course he, especially in this case, he's playing a very old person anyway, so it seemed completely organic to me, and as you say, not one line was missed. So that's what I got. I do see that him concentrating, but it doesn't bother me, and he's just such an amazing actor.
Let me run this by the two of you. So we had basically a card table and two chairs, and the actors for the most part sitting there and doing this. I thought back to a few seasons ago of Love Letters, and I was like, if they had the two of these in James Earl Jones and Cicely Tyson in Love Letters, would that have been a different outcome for that production?
I don't think so, because I do believe that Broadway prices being what they are, people want to see more than that,
right,
than a card table, and that filled about 1/16 of the stage, and I just don't think Love Letters is a property for Broadway. So even with these two in it, and again, they would have been wonderful, of course, but I don't think it would have sold tickets.
I also want to say before she did Trip to Bountiful, it had been what? Decades.
Yeah, a long time since she's been around.
Since Lee Tyson a bit. But whoever she or her managers, her agents, they're certainly picking these properties very, very well. She was perfectly suited to both roles, I thought. And so kudos to whoever is, is behind that.
Yeah.
So Adam Feldman, reviewer for Time Out New York, had written in his review that between the two of them, they have 176 years of of experience, mm-hmm. which is just absolutely, amazing to even think about that.
Sure.
But it is, he wrote that, and I thought he was being sarcastic, and I broke out the Wikipedia, and I was like, oh no, he's being literal.
Yeah.
Well, that Driving Miss Daisy that we mentioned was with Mr. Jones and Miss Lansbury, so maybe she could replace Miss Tyson if the show runs long enough.
All right, so that is running at the Golden Theater. I was looking for an end date. Is it open-ended, or is it a limited run? Do you know?
I don't.
I was looking all over for an end date, so it looks like it's open-ended.
I think it may be one of those soft end dates.
Yeah.
They have one, but they don't.
Sure.
January type of.
That sounds,
depending upon how everybody feels and how ticket sales are doing.
Right.
All right, so get down to the Golden Theater and three thumbs up, or maybe six thumbs up if you count all of our thumbs, for the Gin Game. So next up on the agenda, Peter saw Clever Little Lies. So Peter, tell us about that.
Well, actually, this play does not have clever lies or even little ones. They're big lies and they're not particularly clever. However, the play is very clever because it seems like it's going to be a very sitcom-y type situation. And it gets very serious as time goes on. What fascinated me about this play was that it was about adultery. And what happens is Bill Sr., who we'll call Sr. from now on, even though he's not referred to that way in the script, Bill Sr. and Billy, his son, have a really good relationship. They play tennis. You can tell me anything. So, in fact, he does. He tells his father that he's been fooling around with his 23-year-old trainer, even though he's been married for a while and the wife has just had a baby. And so this is a serious matter. And yet Joe DiPietro comes up with a good number of laughs about it. But more to the point, I really think this is a play that would have been a tragedy many years ago, been written in that way. But it seemed to be the audience was really saying, look, we've all been through divorce. We know what it's like. Yeah, it's not pretty, but you get over it and you move on. And as a result, that allowed the audience to laugh a great deal at this situation. So that really interested me tremendously in seeing the play. But really, you'd swear you were at a Neil Simon comedy at its prime. It really was a situation where the laughs came plentifully and heartily from this audience that just was having the best possible time under these circumstances. It's very nicely done, very, very slickly directed, I'm happy to say. And the four people in it are fine. Marlo Thomas, of course, is the one that everybody concentrates on. And she does give a very nice performance as Billy's mother. Bill Sr. is played by Greg Mulvey. And the thing is, I will say that some of their reactions do seem to be a little out of kilter with people who would be of the baby boomer generation. I'm not saying that Marlo Thomas necessarily is of the baby boomer generation. I think she's a little before that. But nevertheless, if we're talking about somebody who is in his 30s, traditionally, that means it's somebody in the 50s or 60s who had this kid. And therefore, they fit in the baby boomer generation. And some of the reactions weren't exactly what baby boomers would do, because for example, the father is really, really shocked, and I don't want to hear what she does to you sexually, you know, that type of thing. And frankly, we baby boomers have had quite a sexual resume as the years in our early years. So or maybe in our late years, who knows? Anyway, but so that's one thing that strikes me as a little odd. But it's really very, very funny for most of the time. And I have to also praise Kate Weatherhead as Jane, the wife, who is, I don't want to say clueless because that has a negative connotation, but she expects that her husband is devoted to her and that they're going to live happily ever after. She doesn't really see as much of the storm clouds as she might. And but that's done very convincingly. So Joe DiPietro has done a very nice job there in the way that he's handled her. So I thought that was very good indeed. I think the show has a real chance to be a big hit, given the fact that the audience was so crazy for it. And it's not a long play. It doesn't overstay its welcome. It's about 90 minutes, no intermission. And I thought it hit the spot.
So back almost 2 years ago, I'm looking here in our archives, and we talked to Joe DiPietro just as Clever Little Lies opened at George Street.
Oh, uh-huh. Yes. Yeah.
So I have to go back and listen to that episode. I'll put a link to it in the show notes if you want to hear what Joe is saying out of his own mouth about this production. But, you know, Joe just keeps on putting work. He
Doesn't
is a workhorse.
You bet.
He's just unstoppable. I know that he and I chat every now and then, and he's back and forth to London where he's got He's got Memphis running or something in London, and all these other things going on. He's always on a plane, and he's always writing, and he's doing great stuff, and such a wonderful guy. So go check that out. I'll put that in the show notes as well. So next up, Peter and Michael got a chance to see the Perfect Arrangement at the Duke on 42nd Street. And Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Sure. This play is set in Washington, D.C. in the spring of 1950. And the interesting thing about it is that the basic initial setup, it struck me, is quite similar to what is going on in It Should Have Been You. Because what you have here is two couples when we first see them, there's presumably two heterosexual couples. But then as soon as the guests leave, it turns out that the two women are with each other and the two men are with each other. And isn't that sort of what was being planned and Should Have Been You? This play, although there's a lot of humor in it and it starts out quite funny, it gets much more serious. It's a really, really wonderful play by Topher Payne. And what happens is, and you know, I normally would not give maybe this much of a spoiler as I already did, but I noticed that that's what it says in the press release. So I think the feeling is that although we're not initially supposed to understand that these two gay couples are with each other, we do find that out within the first 15 minutes or so. So I guess that's they don't think that's a spoiler in that sense. But the main action of the play is that two of these four people work for the U.S. State Department. And this is at the height of the witch hunts, the McCarthy era, I guess initially began as ferreting out "quote unquote communists," but then that started to include sexual deviance. So, as you can imagine,
so-called sexual deviance.
Yes, I'm. Thank you very much. Yes, "quote unquote." Thank you. Yeah, boy. Thank you. All right. And so, as you can imagine, these four, given their arrangement, they're on eggshells, and it's like, what is going to happen? How are we going to get through this? And it's a really, I thought, very, very well written play by this Topher Payne, who is from Kosciusko, Mississippi, and apparently has a lot of experience in writing plays, but I believe this is his New York debut, isn't that correct?
I think so.
Yeah. Directed by Michael Barakiva. Wonderful performances. Julia Coffey, who was so great in London Wall and got a Drama Desk nomination for that performance. Robert Ely, Michaela Feely Lehman, Christopher J. Hankey, back from are having seen him in How to Succeed and also in, I didn't see him in it, but he did Buyer and Seller. Kelly McAndrew, Kevin O'Rourke, and Jennifer Van Dyke. And a quite a wonderful production at the Duke on 42nd Street. It's a Primary Stages production because that's their temporary home. Although I think they're moving on from there. I think that's already been announced. I would absolutely get to this. I've been seeing so many wonderful new plays recently, and it really does my heart good, you know, because I do think that it all comes, you know, the writing is the foundation. And as we've discussed many times, we're all spoiled in terms of always seeing so many good actors and set designs and costumes and directing. But if the writing itself is really so solid, then I think that's the basis of everything. And it certainly was the case here.
All right, Peter, what did you think?
I liked it very much, too, because it really pointed out not only was it difficult to be homosexual at that time, but it was difficult to be a woman too. There's a lot in this play about women's rights and women and expectations for women. Lines like "the hens have hatched a plan to spend our money," not said by any of the four people that Michael referenced, but there's another couple, the boss of the gentleman in the relationship, and also the fact that one of the guys is a teacher, and how difficult that would be if that got out. And while this is still an issue today, it's far less of an issue, but these people are really quite scared as time. And not everybody. One guy is convinced that everything's fine, it's all going to work out. You need that in a play. You need the orchestration of character, to be sure. But the rest of them are really very scared. And the way it plays out, by the way, is surprising. And some people have criticized the play already for saying, well, I think that's a little too forward-thinking the way it ends, that 1950 is too early for somebody to, I'll say this, to become a pioneer in changing things. But no, those people were there in the 50s. They may not have been successful, but they were there. They were trying. And that's what basically happens as the play goes on. Somebody makes a commitment to saying, I am tired of staying in the closet. That line isn't used, though the closet is used. These are two adjoining apartments. And what they've done is they've taken the door out of the closet. So as a result, they can go back and forth and back and forth without going outside the, to the front doors. So when they have visitors, yes, indeed, it's supposed to be the man and woman's apartment while the other man and woman are in the other one. But of course, when everybody goes home, the ladies stay together and the men do as well in their own apartment. We only see one of the apartments. We see the women's apartment. But what a great idea for a show to talk about what it was like to be gay in the 50s and thinking that you have really solved every problem that you have simply by having this perfect arrangement, because nobody's going to be wiser. We can get away with it. And the whole point of the play is that's not what it's about. It's not getting away with it. It's the idea that it has to change. And it makes us think about these people. You know, we think of Stonewall and all that, but there were people before Stonewall. And it's nice to be able to think about these people and honor them in our minds as a result of seeing this play.
Well, I was thinking that the Temperamentals would be a good companion piece for this play.
Yeah, you know, I said recently, I don't know if I said it here, but I know I've said it, the Leonard Pelkey play, I fully expect, will be in an anthology of great gay plays 50 years from now. And I think this one will too, because it really is terribly significant in setting up the beginnings, the real early seeds of the gay liberation movement. So I welcome this play with open arms for bringing up something that we don't usually see, what it was like to be gay, just as the McCarthy machine was starting.
All right, great. So Peter and Michael also got a chance to see Rothschild and Sons at the York Theatre Company. Peter, why don't you start us off with Rothschild and Sons?
Well, I always liked the Rothschilds when I saw it way back in 1971. Unfortunately, I saw it the week that Hal Linden was out, so I saw his understudy, who was not very good and also brought down the rest of the company. So the show was a disappointment to me then. I saw a workshop of this new version, Rothschilds and Sons, which really is the logical title for the show. And in fact, even in 1970, I was saying, gee, you know, since they have this marvelous song called Rothschilds and Sons, it really should be the title song. But I knew why they were calling it the Rothschilds, because in 1961, there was an enormous bestseller called The Rothschilds, determining the fate of this family. Actually, if you read the book, and I did start it, and that's all I needed to do, because the part that the musical involves is only about the first 80 pages. That's what they're really concentrating on. And it's a magnificent story, because this is a time when Jews in Frankfurt were really, really oppressed. We talk about the gays in Perfect Arrangement, but here, these people were locked in every night at 10 o'clock, and you'd better be there by 10 o'clock, and that was that. And Rothschild's wife, Gitala, uses the rationalization, hey, if they lock us in, at least we've locked them out. We don't have to deal with them, you know, and that's a rationalization, and everybody knows it. And Meyer Rothschild is not going to have this happen. He is going to change things, and he knows the only way that you can change things is by making a lot of money. So this is not a case where Well, for example, years ago, somebody tried to get on a musical about Neiman Marcus, and talking about, and it didn't happen because you don't want to watch people get rich. That's not enough. You know, we can't really spend joyous time thinking about, wow, Stanley Marcus got rich. No. The thing with the Rothschilds is he's not getting rich for himself. In fact, his wife, after he died, lived in the ghetto for quite some time because that's what she was used to. But what they want to do is liberate the people, and they know by having a lot of money and therefore getting involved with the government and saying, you need our money because there's a war going on and all this kind of stuff, but we want you to tear down those walls. That's what has to happen if you're going to get our money. So, but, you know, this show almost has as much suspense as 1776 because you start watching it and you think, how can they possibly make this happen? This poor guy who's literally a poor guy who's a coin dealer, and they take advantage of him and all that. But what I love most about the Rothschild in Sherman Yellen's terrific book is at the beginning of the show, you find out it's not as well done here as it was originally because they actually had children. Mm. The Jews were, by law, had to take off their hat and bow whenever they approached a Gentile. So now this has become a kid's game. Going up to – it's great fun to be 8 years old and go up to somebody who's in his 50s and say, Jew, do your duty. And the Jew has to take off the hat and bow low because – this is a Gentile. I mean, that is really horrifying, but it's so wonderful at the end of the show when Prince Metternich must bow to the Rothschilds. Mm-hmm. So that is a really terrific thing. The score by Bach and Harnack, regrettably their last. Tremendous songs. Wonderful, wonderful songs. Wonderful ideas, especially two songs that were written on the road in Philadelphia. He Tossed a Coin, in which we see how Meyer made his sales. I'm not going to give too much of it away. And In My Own Lifetime, where he looks back on his life and see what he's achieved. We've climbed much higher than I ever thought we'd climb. Indeed, he certainly has, and so has the family. This is a Vest Pocket production. We're at the York Theater. There are 11 people there. And while Jeffrey Moss has done a wonderful job in directing it, there's a lot of doubling, And I credit the lighting designer at the beginning for making the people say, Jew, do your duty, so we can't really see their faces terribly well, because they're going to be the sons in no time flat, you know. So it does suffer a little from doubling. The real problem with the doubling comes when the children are introduced. Now, originally, they were really played by little boys. One of them was, in fact, a very young Robbie Benson. Mm. And there was a terrific moment where they're threatened and they have to go down to the cellar to hide. And when the threat is over, they come out and they're actually grown men. That's what happened originally. You didn't see the boys anymore. You saw their grown men. And, of course, the point of it is, too, the fact that this has been going on a long time, that they've had to go in the cellar and hide, and they're damn sick of it. So unfortunately here, there's a big section where Meyer, in a wonderful song called Sons, is educating his sons on how to be good merchants in the store that they now have. And unfortunately, because these adult actors have to play children, you know, they have to put on these little voices and all that. And unfortunately, they even come across someone as developmentally disabled, you know, and that's just something you're going to have to put up with, because after all, the York doesn't have enough money to hire five kids and keep them on the payroll. So if you're going to suspend your disbelief there, you're going to have a very good time with the Rothschilds, because I'm telling you, that book is so solid, and I cannot let this go without talking about Robert Cuccioli as Meyer Rothschild in a dynamic, perfect performance. And matching him, I think, tremendously is Glory Crampton, an actress I've known a lot from Paper Mill. And when she came on, it's structured as a flashback now. When she came on, I said, oh, gee, I guess they hired another actress to play her at an older age, because she didn't even remotely look like she did in the scenes when she's younger. Mm-hmm. Tremendous adaptation there to be a very, very old woman. So I liked her immeasurably as well. And aside from the problems I mentioned, I think the cast is fine and the direction solid. And I hope there's a future for this show. I'd like to see it move, and I'd like to see it with five children.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Yes, I completely agree. I thought that both Robert and Glory gave superb performances. Really, really excellent. I guess my curiosity is, I mean, obviously this was an attempt to recast the show as a chamber musical as opposed to what was on Broadway originally, which was really quite a grand production in many ways. But I wonder how much of the diminution or whatever is because of is in the script itself, and how much is because it's being produced at the York, which doesn't have a lot of money. I completely agree about the missing the having actual young boys in the Sun's number. And unfortunately, I hate to say it, the lyrics really, really do not work when they're played by clearly adult men. So that was a tremendous loss. But I wonder, Peter, in the original, did they just pay to have all of those boys for basically one number and then we never saw them again?
Well, of course, they were in the beginning when they were taunting the Jersey, right? Yeah. But aside from that, yeah, that was it. You know,
so
I
guess they went home early and they went to bed early.
Unless they wanted their curtain calls, you know, they might very well have. You know, I mean, so I don't remember if they came out at the end when it was 45 years ago, 44 actually. But all things considered, I'm afraid yes, it is a problem. Anyway, go on.
Well, yeah, so I completely realize from a logistical standpoint why there weren't boys, but I think that I'm honestly I would say don't do this if you can't have the boys, because it just it's mm-hmm. so important. And also I really miss the chorus in for example Pleasure and Privilege and other numbers and He Tossed a Coin. So I think that in many ways they were successful in making it a chamber musical, but I'm not sure. I would say basically if I saw this same production but with a chorus and with boys, I think that would have made a tremendous difference. And I hope that we do get to see it again. I hope we get to see it with those elements in it.
Well, let's not forget that back in 1990 or so, there was a revival.
Yeah.
It was done first at the little Jewish theater that was under the supermarket on 23rd Street. It's now called the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. And it was so successful that it moved to Circle in the Square downtown when there used to be Circle in the Square on Bleecker Street. It's now a mall of little shops. So this is not new, that all this doubling that went on and all that. So that happened there. I haven't mentioned, and it's unconscionable that I haven't, is the fact that the second act of the show has pretty much been junked. And Sherman Yellen went back, and so did Sheldon Harnick. Jerry Bock, unfortunately, is no longer with us. That they eliminated the love story between Nathan, the real mover and shaker of the five kids. And by the way, there were 10 kids. There were five daughters, too, by the way. Mm-hmm. That doesn't come up at all. But for the record, that was a family of 10 kids. Can you imagine? Anyway, so they felt that they needed a love story because musicals have love stories. And they spent time with that. And as Sheldon Harnick told me, Jerry Bock's son, who was about 12 years old, said to him, you're so stupid. Why are you dealing with the love story when the real love story is between the father and the sons? You know, and the difficulties go with that as well. And so they've concentrated more on that. And they've really kept their eye on the ball. They're not worried about the personal lives of the sons. It's much more important to talk about what's really important here. And that is, you know, making those walls come down. And that's so they keep their eye. So it's really more potent than it was in 1970, where it became very conventional in the second act with that love story. So there have been improvements, no question about it, because even in 1990, it was a case where they just did the show as it was. I mean, with fewer people, granted, but they used the exact same text that had been used 20 years earlier.
Oh, one other thing I will say, I don't know why they did this. This production is 2 hours without an intermission. I don't know why they didn't put an intermission. There was a completely natural place for it, and I don't think that that's really such a great thing to do to an audience. So I'm sorry they'd made that decision, and I wish they would rethink it for the rest of the run, but I don't suppose that's going to happen. Peter, just a quick question. I haven't actually read up on it. I'm sure it's probably been stated. The few songs that are completely new, quote-unquote, to the show, do we assume that they were cut?
I know Just a Map was. Okay. There's a song that is very clever. I don't know if it's historically accurate, in which Gidula, as a mother, looks at the map because her sons are all over the place and talking about how pretty the map is with different colors, the pink, you know, representing one country, the yellow representing another. And the fact that it's not just a case where these countries are pretty little abstract things. I mean, that's where her kids are. That was definitely a song that they had way back when. Some of the material did seem unfamiliar to me, and I don't know if it's new or old. That's the only one I know about.
Well, I noticed some new lyrics to music from the original, but then there were a couple of songs that you know.
Oh, yeah, a lot of new lyrics, right. Yes, yeah. That's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
All right. Michael got a chance to see Please Excuse My Dear Aunt Sally at 59 East 59. Michael, tell us about that quickly.
Yes, this is a play by Kevin Armento, directed by Iante Dimos. It's a production of the 1 year lease theater company at 59 East 59th Street. And it's a very, very creative telling of an affair between a female teacher and her, I guess, high school age student, told through the boy's cell phone, which was a little confusing at times, but also very creative. You have to realize that whenever you hear the word "I," it's supposed to be the cell phone talking about what, you know, what it's seeing, the texts that it's transmitting and the photos and the emails. Really very, very creatively staged and interestingly written. So I would put this on another as another example of one of the really good things that I've seen lately that I mentioned before, just really some really good work on stages right now. Cast Danny Bernardi, Sarah Jane Casey, Nick Flint, Christina Bennett Lind, and Ethan Slater. It was a very short run, September 30th through October 24th. But if you can get to it, I would say that it's very much worth your while.
All right, great. So we're going to wrap up here, but before we get to trivia, I just want to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time you have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and get us streamed to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me, as well as things that we've talked about today, can be found on our show page at BroadwayRadio.com as well. So, Peter, why don't you give us an answer to last week's trivia?
Well, Rob Johnson got it. He wrote me, and he knew what current character on Broadway has a surname as the same as a performer who took over the lead role in a Tony-winning a performance that had won a Tony. So the answer is Gabor. In Spring Awakening is the current character, but Ava Gabor took over for Vivian Lee in the musical Tvarich back in 1963. So that's the answer to that one, and my congratulations to Rob Johnson, who I had met at the Broadway Flea Market, a charming man, and and a smart one, too.
I tell you, Rob has got some pretty impressive set of photographs with various Broadway stars at stage doors. I would venture to say that they're in the hundreds, if not approaching 1,000 pictures.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's great. He is definitely a Broadway fan. So Michael has a question that he's going to throw out to the listeners for the trivia this week.
Yes. Okay, there is a musical in which at one point the leading lady is asked her name by the leading man, and she gives a false name for various reasons. There is another musical in which at one point the leading man calls the leading lady by a name other than her own. What, and in both cases, it's the same name in these two different musicals. So what is the name, and what are the musicals, and what are the characters?
Once again, stumped by my dynamic duo on the other side of the microphone from me. So if you know this, email to let me know what the answer is. trivia@broadwayradio.com. And if so, we will let you know next week. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made my hit parade.
Guys like me, we had it made. Those were the days. Didn't need no welfare state.
Everybody pulled his weight.
G.R.O. was sour and great. Those were the days.
And you knew where you were.
Man. Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. People seem to be content. $50 paid the rent. Freaks were in a circus tent. Those were the days.
Take a little Sunday speed.
Gotta watch the Dodgers win.
Have yourself a dandy.
Cost you under a fin.
Hair was short and skirts were long. Kate Smith really sold a song.
I don't know just what went wrong.